Dan Egan has covered the Asian carp issue as closely as any reporter anywhere. Recently, he published a series of articles about the use of eDNA and the controversy that erupted when the tests drew into question the federal government's efforts to protect the Great Lakes. eDNA tests were developed by David Lodge at Notre Dame. He compares them to fingerprints at a crime scene. But as the positive test results have stacked up over the years, fisheries biologists have seldom been able to catch a fish to verify the science. So Dan Egan says what the eDNA tests mean depends on who you ask.
If you ask the federal agencies, they say that means that there is the presence of Asian carp DNA in the water, not necessarily the presence of Asian carp. If you talk to the scientists who developed this tool, they will say it likely means the presence of actual fish. The big contention is how the DNA gets in there. And there are other ways for DNA to get into the water besides live fish. In Chicago specifically, it could be getting in there from contaminated bilge water from barges traveling up the Chicago Sanitary and Ship Canal. And the Notre Dame scientists who developed this DNA surveillance tool will acknowledge that there probably are some positive samples that are a result of some other means of transport besides live fish. But they say the overall pattern, both in terms of time and space, really paints a picture that makes it clear that there are at least some live fish swimming in those waters. Lake Erie I don't understand the Lake Erie hydrology as well as I do that of Chicago, but they did have some big head Asian carp caught in the western part of Lake Erie between 1995 and 2000. I believe they caught 3 fish, adult fish. They don't know how they got there. They say, and when I say they, I'm talking about government biologists, that it's not necessarily an indication of a breeding population because these fish have been raised on fish farms and they could have been somehow released or escaped into Lake Erie and never successfully got a breeding population going.
And so the scientists, David Lodge and the others that conduct this research, if they do acknowledge that you can get a positive test result for reasons other than a live fish, why exactly are they confident that generally a positive test result does mean a live fish?
I think you need to make a distinction between a positive test result and the pattern of results that they've acquired over the last 3 years. Suppose bilge water is an explanation for a positive hit. Well, that isn't an explanation for a positive hit in the North Shore Channel, north of downtown Chicago, because there are no barges operating in those waters. Suppose a sewer outfall is a potential explanation. Somebody ate big head carp, and it somehow survived through their digestive tract, the DNA, through the sewage treatment system, such as it is in Chicago, and made it into the water. Again, north of Chicago, they've had hits above any sewage treatment plant outfalls. They've had hits in winter when a lot of the birds that might theoretically be transporting this stuff aren't there. So they look at the picture that's emerged over almost 3 years now and say, there's no other real good explanation for all these genetic fingerprints than the fact that there are fish swimming in these waters. And the government is pretty adamant that the electric barrier is doing its job holding back the fish, but that barrier has a history of failures. And the science behind it has never been peer-reviewed to the extent, never period, has it been peer-reviewed, where this DNA as a surveillance tool has been published in a peer-reviewed scientific journal. It's gone through 2 government reviews, and it's been deemed a legitimate tool for looking for rare species.
This was the part of your recent reporting that was really interesting, I thought, was the history of the use of this technology. Because initially, the Army Corps welcomed it, even though it had not been peer-reviewed at that time. It was somewhat novel, but they brought it in and wanted to use it. What was the position the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers was in then?
Well, they common sense told them and everybody else that even though no live fish had been found within about 15 miles of this electric barrier, the migration history of the fish showed that they should be farther north. They should be pressing the barrier zone on the canal, which is about 35 miles downstream from Lake Michigan. But they were finding no fish. Now, they also weren't even looking that hard. The Army Corps biologists will acknowledge that before 2008, they were just kind of sporadically sniffing around with nets and electroshockers in the canal waters looking for the fish, but it wasn't a concerted, organized effort. So they wanted to know where the leading edge of this invasion was, so they would know how best to operate this electric barrier. It was built to operate at 4 volts per inch, and at the time that they started using the DNA, it was only operating at 1 volt per inch, which is not a voltage strong enough to repel small carp. So the Army Corps bosses wanted a better sense of where the fish were, and they turned to David Lodge from Notre Dame and his team and asked them to start trying to lift fingerprints, genetic fingerprints from the water, if you will, to give them a better sense of where the fish may be. These are remarkably cryptic fish in that they're very hard to catch when they're at low densities with traditional tools like nets, fish shocking devices, or even poison, because they know how to avoid nets. These electroshockers, they make different types, but the ones commonly used really aren't effective at depths that the Chicago Canal system reaches. I've heard people say after 8 feet they may be no good at all, and they also may have the reverse effect on the fish that people would expect. Rather than driving them to the surface, it can drive them down. And then as far as poisoning, Asian carp, for reasons I don't completely understand, aren't like a lot of other species of fish in that when they are poisoned, they don't float to the surface right away. In fact, they won't float unless the water's warm enough for gases to build up in their belly, and that can take days up to a week, and then they'll pop to the surface. So if you're poisoning in cold water, you may never see them. When they conducted the canal poisoning in 2009, it was December. It was cold water.
And so how did the Corps get so turned around on this?
I think they thought this was a magic bullet to begin with. I think that they thought that, boy, we're going to sniff these things out like we've never been able to. We'll know where they are. We'll know how to respond to that. Once they started using it and they started getting positive samples, but they weren't following that up with actual fish in nets or floating to the surface after poisonings or driven to the surface by electroshocking, they started to wonder, well, just how effective is it? The Notre Dame people look at this as kind of a backwards approach to the whole idea of environmental DNA or eDNA. They argue that it's so sensitive that you're going to get DNA all over the place before you're going to get an actual fish, because it could be telling you that, or it could be revealing only a handful of fish. There's a lot of problems with it and with DNA in that it's really just a yes/no tool. Yes, there's genetic material in the water. No, there isn't. It doesn't tell you how many fish there are, whether they're breeding, where they are precisely. So it's problematic for somebody who has to make a difficult decision as far as water management or fish management. It's kind of like somebody handing you a pair of night vision goggles and saying, "See that blob? That's the enemy. Shoot." Well, if you're the guy who has to pull the trigger, it's a little bit harder to make that decision.
As you put it at one point in one of your articles, it's only as powerful as the trust you put in it.
Exactly.
But the Corps continues to use this technology.
Yeah, you know, at the same time that they poo-poo it, have poo-pooed it, they're investing in it. It's not being used just in Chicago anymore. They're using it on the Mississippi, up near the Twin Cities. They're using it out west to look for rare species. They're using it in Europe to do whole species surveys of lakes. It's a tool, but it's a frustrating one for the people who have to make the difficult decisions. You can see everybody's perspective if you think about how this has unfolded. You can see the Notre Dame scientists being frustrated that their technology, their science is somehow less than legitimate or proven. And you can see conservation groups frustrated that the Army Corps has been given this very high-tech tool, and it's basically not done a lot with it, other than to use it to figure out where to put their nets to try to find fish that are almost impossible to catch in nets if they're at low densities. It's a circular thing. It's difficult for everybody.
Well, the actions that the Corps might take here are very high stakes, things like shutting down locks in the Chicago area.
Yeah, and you know, that lock closure debate, it really, you know, the conservationists that were pushing for it have backed away. There's still the lawsuit filed by the state of Michigan and several other Great Lakes states that initially sought to close the locks, but I think most people's focus now is a more permanent solution, one that would both stop the flow of species between the lakes, the Great Lakes and the Mississippi Basin, and would still allow for wastewater to move safely through Chicago as well as barge traffic. Now, that's a complicated, huge undertaking that wouldn't happen overnight. It would be years, if not more than a decade. But this is an issue that is bigger than Asian carp. The Army Corps has identified 39 species that are considered a threat to move either from the Great Lakes into the Mississippi or from the Mississippi into the Great Lakes. And the biggest reason for this is the Chicago Sanitary and Ship Canal, which is an unnatural connection between the two once separated basins. People don't talk about this much, but the Mississippi Basin stands to gain or lose just as much in this debate as the Great Lakes, if not more. For example, VHS, the virus that kills dozens of fish species that's now floating in the Great Lakes waters from Milwaukee to, I think, Lake Erie, all across the basin, could go down the canal. I mean, that bug could get down the canal and get into the catfish farming country of the South, which could be devastating. That's just one species or one bug, one organism, virus.
So if the Corps took these DNA tests more seriously, what action would people want to see from them at this point?
You know, The Corps' mission isn't to stop organisms from swimming up its canals and down its canals. Its mission is to control floodwaters and to move cargo. They may not be the agency that could actually move the earth, but this is a decision that's going to be made outside of their realm, I would argue. I mean, it's got a lot of support, bipartisan support, and wide geographical support. I mean, even the mayor of Chicago is interested in looking at what it'll take and what the potential benefits and consequences are to re-engineering the Chicago River. I think that the frustration people have right now is expressed by some of the conservation groups that I talked to, is that this DNA tool is basically just that it's an alarm saying, look, the problem isn't an abstraction and it isn't years off. The problem is here. There's an urgency here that isn't really necessarily being acknowledged.
Yeah, you say, I think either David Lodge or you use the word to describe his position that an invasion is imminent.
Yeah, I mean, he's the biologist, the invasive species expert. He's putting all of his expertise, knowledge, and, you know, reputation on the line with that statement. And I reported that. But he's not alone. And like I said, this is the Chicago Sanitary and Ship Canal is a problem that's much bigger than Asian carp. I mean, it gets to water management. Chicago, if you talk to regional planners there, they'll tell you that they're going to have a water quantity issue this century because they're capped at the amount of Lake Michigan water they can take a day, and their western suburbs are increasingly relying on that allocation, and it won't be enough to go around as we move deeper into the century. If they re-engineer the river so they can basically put Chicago back into the Great Lakes Basin, that cap would be lifted, and that water quantity problem would evaporate.
So what interests are preventing serious exploration of separating the Great Lakes Basin from the Mississippi River Basin?
Well, there are numerous explorations that have gone on or are going on. The Great Lakes Commission and the Great Lakes St. Lawrence Seaway City Initiative, which is a group of Great Lakes mayors, including Chicago's, Milwaukee's, Detroit's, all the big cities and smaller cities of the Great Lakes, they put together $2 million and funded their own engineering study looking at how this separation could be accomplished and what it would cost and what the benefits would be. That came out in February. The Army Corps is in the middle of its own study, but that's a five-year project at the very least. The Congress just this summer instructed them to finish it in 18 months, and the Corps has yet to respond. I think there's a frustration that among people outside of some of the federal agencies that they aren't responding, as I said earlier, with the urgency that the situation demands. It's not a problem that's going to be solved easily, and it's not a problem that's going to go away on its own. It's a big problem.
Will the Corps' report include an analysis of separating the basins?
Yes, it's supposed to. They're looking at they're not only looking at hydrological separation. They're looking at just different devices, tools, techniques to prevent species from moving between the two basins. But separation is a component of that. They've been working on it for a while now. I think that 90 day they were given 90 days to respond to this congressional directive to speed things up, and that 90 days hasn't passed yet. I don't know what the date is. I've got to look into that. So really, though, I mean, this to me, this story is like it's just full of gray. But I think the one thing that a lot of people don't see as gray is the fact that there is a threat to the biological, what's left of the biological integrity of the Great Lakes, that isn't necessarily being addressed with the urgency that it deserves.
Dan, nice to talk with you.
All right, thanks a lot.